Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome back to The Critic Books podcast. This week, Paul Lay, our literary editor, is speaking to Anna Kay about her book, The Restless Republic.
Well, hello, Anna.
Hello.
One of the things that really struck me about when I was reading this book, the first really striking phrase that I came across was your claim that it was born of ignorance. And, I'm thinking, ignorance, you know, this is a person who's written a biography of the Duke of Monmouth, written magnificently, if you'll excuse the pun, about the court of Charles II. And so why was this something that you felt you had this kind of gap there? I mean, do you think this is this is plainly a widespread gap in the nation's ignorance, never mind historians?
Yeah, it's a funny thing, isn't it? I mean, I felt, so starting a book by saying this book is born of ignorance clearly slightly risks alienating your audience from the start. But it, as you say, it was, I kind of meant it really, because I think that for lots of us, those of us who've done a lot of work on this period, and those who haven't, but just, you know, interested in history generally, it feels often like there's a sort of little leap that happens. The Civil War breaks out, Charles I is executed, fast forward, it's 1660, and the restoration of the monarchy happens. Now, clearly, for serious historians who work on the 17th century, there's a whole world of people who inhabit the years of revolution and write about it. But I feel like that's something that exists in a slightly its own sort of subculture, and that for the general reader, I mean, if you're in Waterstones and going along the shelves, or you read history magazines and so on, you'd be forgiven for thinking that we never had a revolution. And I think, you know, the reason for that is partly to do with, you know, there's a sort of certain glamour attached to books about kings and queens and all that stuff. But I think it's also partly because in 1660, all the constitutional changes were reversed. There's a sort of sense in which you might reasonably think, well, I don't want to get detained with that for too long because, you know, it didn't come to anything. And I suppose I felt very conscious that there was this big chunk of this century, which I've done quite a lot of work on over the years, which felt to me like terra incognita, like it was just a different world. And it got me thinking a bit about, that's ridiculous, because it's a whole decade, but also a bit, what must it have been like for people at the time? Because it must have been a different world, you know, times a thousand. And this thought of, you know, the people who would be walking through New Palace Yard in 1670, you know, with Charles II on the throne, and, you know, Samuel Pepys writing his diaries and all that kind of stuff, that they lived right the way through that period of extraordinary constitutional, political and religious change. And, you know, they woke up in the morning and, you know, put on their socks and got on with life. And so I guess for all those different layers of reasons about feeling that this was a decade that had somehow been forgotten, and yet one which was so eventful and extraordinary, and made me feel like I really wanted to try and get to grips with it, and to sort of acknowledge that in doing that I was coming to it, you know, also feeling like it was an unfamiliar territory.
And one of the many things I think you achieve with this book is make plain that this is a new world emerging from the old, in a way. And I think that's particularly evident in the story about Anne Green and William Petty. The relationship is that you have, I suppose, what Keith Thomas used to call about the disenchantment of the world. You see this process almost happening whereby, you can tell us the story of Anne Green and William Petty, but you see an old world of superstition, of magic, of enchantment slowly being replaced by this more rational, scientific world. And it's in that process, and it's quite dramatic, that story you tell us about Anne Green and William Petty.
Yeah, so it was a famous story at the time, which was that there was a young woman who was being executed for murder, for murdering her child in Oxford in the early 1650s, and she was hung, dangled there for half an hour, cut down, stamped on a few times to make sure she was dead, put in a coffin, and her body was taken by some Oxford scientists who wanted the bodies to do dissection on. And as they were about to sink their scalpels into her, she slightly stirred and they realised she was still alive. And over the subsequent days, they did various things in terms of tending to her and ministering to her and trying to keep her warm and so on. That, as a consequence of which, she made a full recovery. And at the time, it was treated as a miracle. But it was also clearly to do with the things that William Petty, who was one of these scientists, had been doing, and the way they went about looking after her and the very detailed notes they kept of her symptoms and what how she responded to various sorts of treatments and so on, was all the sort of language of what we think of as being modern medicine now. And so it's the story was, it became very famous, and it was written about in the papers, which were taking such news across the country, that William Petty had brought her back from the dead. And it was a funny story because it was a mix, it was ambiguous as to whether he brought her back from the dead through, as you reference, sort of mysterious, perhaps divinely orchestrated powers, or whether he'd done something, as it were, scientific that had brought her back. Because this is absolutely that moment where new science is coming to the fore, where William Harvey had just established that blood circulates around the body, and which it began to unlock the whole understanding of human anatomy and so on.
And of course there would have been the view among some that the fact that she survived was kind of God's providential judgment that she was innocent.
Absolutely. And actually the scientists themselves made good use of this, because they said she should have, the scientists clubbed together to try and sort of plead her case, because of course she was still condemned, saying, well, you know, clearly she, God has made clear her innocence by delivering her. So they weren't saying our brilliant science has delivered her. It was, God's showed his view on this, and actually it turned out that she actually hadn't murdered her child. She'd had a miscarriage. She'd been seduced by the son of the person that she worked for. She was in service, and she was very much the wronged person in the end, as it turned out. But if, as you say, an episode, it's a great example of how it wasn't just the case that everything went from being mystical, providential, mysterious doings of divinity to science. There was an amazing period of intermingling of the two. And I always think of Samuel Pepys being on the boat with Charles II when he was restored. And he came across with Charles II, and he had one of the King's Spaniels sitting on his knee. It's a wonderful Charles II living up to all the old stories. And the Spaniel weed on his lap. And Samuel Pepys comments, makes me see that kings are only just as other people are. All the sort of mystique about majesty. And yet, he lived in a world where people lined up in their thousands to be cured from disease by Charles II. So it is, to me, it's one of the things that's so fascinating about the 17th century is it's on the cusp of whole changes to people's belief systems and understanding of the world, and the intermingling of those and sort of coexistence of those different ways of seeing the world. It's absolutely fascinating.
And Petty's achievements, his scientific achievements, are extraordinary because they're built on the back of what I suppose is generally the most notorious episode of this period, which is Cromwell's conquest of Ireland.
Mm.
Henry Ireton conquer Ireland. I don't think even the most fierce apologists for Cromwell would deny that was a brutal episode in Anglo-Irish history. But because of that, there was another kind of conquest of Ireland that was done through science, and Petty was very much the agent of that.
Yes, exactly. So the bit that we know about, people on the whole know about, is this really utterly merciless and brutal conquest of Ireland by the Puritan army led by Oliver Cromwell in 1649 to 51. But once that had happened, in a way, much more far-reaching consequences in terms of the number of people it affected and how long it would govern things, was the redistribution of land that followed on from that victory, which wasn't something of Oliver Cromwell's making, wasn't something of the Republican government's making, right back long before any of this happened, when Charles I was still sitting firmly on his throne. The terms that were established for funding English action in Ireland were premised on those people, the investors who put up the money, being paid from the lands that would be confiscated from the conquered Irish. So the Irish were, you know, on the hook for something terrible right back in 1641.
Yeah, which is the uprising.
Which is when there was an uprising, a Catholic uprising, which Charles I sent an army over to put down, which was the beginning of the sort of Irish leg of the kind of wing of the events of the Civil War.
And Ireland was always seen as the base on which that counter-revolution would come from.
Yeah, exactly. So because Ireland was overwhelmingly Catholic, clearly the Republican government was very strongly Puritan, so it was always going to be somewhere that, you know, was regarded as being a place from which a royalist, you know, reinvasion, reconquest might happen. So, but as well as that, there were the very pressing, very practical requirements of the funding model that had been used for the conquest of Ireland, which is to say that having the Cromwell and co. having managed to secure control of Ireland, they had this huge army who'd been part of that, who they needed to pay off because it cost a fortune to keep them employed, and they could only pay off the army if they could extract the lands from all the Irish landowners who were going to be forced to give it up. And in order to do that, this is a world of amazing consequences, in order to do that, you had to actually know what lands there were and who owned them. And there was no very sophisticated mapping of most of Ireland. There were bits, but not the island as a whole. And so a enterprise was set in train to create new maps of Ireland that allowed you to then identify what belonged to who, extract it from those Catholic owners, give it to those Protestant soldiers or investors. And William Petty, who was a doctor at this stage, he was an Oxford scientist, who'd got a job as being a doctor to the army in Ireland, was standing on the sidelines watching all these surveyors who'd been given the job of mapping Ireland and bustling around with their measuring tools and so on, and with a mounting sense that this map was going to be a disaster. The thing was going to obviously take a decade to do. You could see how it was going to be inaccurate, it was going to cost a fortune. And he, because he was one of these sort of brilliant, intellectually incredibly capable, utterly self-confident people, sort of leapt up and put forward a proposal for doing the map himself and saying, I can do this for half the price. I can do it using the soldiers of the army who are sitting around with nothing much to do because the island's been conquered, and I can do it in 1 year. And it was this extraordinary idea, because he was the map maker. He'd never made a map in his life. He'd never really been in charge of anything in his life as far as a kind of big enterprise went. But it was too tempting to turn down. And as the book elaborates, he pulled it off. He did it. And it was the most sophisticated mapping of a whole country to be undertaken, well, anywhere really in Europe at the time, possible exception of some work in Sweden. But, you know, generally speaking, it was totally new standard of detail and of sophistication in mapping. And actually, there's a wonderful website called the Down Survey website, which is a wonderful thing to look at, because it basically has facsimiles of all the William Petty maps that go down to each tiny little sub-parish of Ireland. And you can essentially roam around Ireland in the 1650s through that map. It's, you know, so complete and so accurate, is it?
The opposite to that brutal conquest of Ireland, whether it was done through military means or ultimately scientific in terms of the cartography there, is England, in a way, is that the picture you paint is of one that's perhaps gentler than one might expect of a post-revolutionary society, if indeed it was a revolution. I mean, we could argue about that all day. But you make the point, and I mean, it's a point that's often missed, but I think it's absolutely right, that most of the people on both sides during the civil wars were monarchical to some extent. They supported the idea of a monarchy, whether it was a crown in parliament or moving towards absolutism. And there was, you know, when we think about the parliamentary army, it was commandeered at first by two nobles. Mm. And nobles played an enormous part in the origins of that conflict. It was by no means this one of radicals and levellers at the beginning of the conflict. And there's that kind of spectrum of both sides of that divide. Why do you think it was like that? Do you think it was a society emerging from conflict that wanted security at any cost? I mean, remember, this is also the period of Hobbes, which is very much that idea of giving one's freedom over to the Leviathan, because it can provide security. How much do you think that was a factor in the relatively peaceful, benign nature of life during the interregnum, the protectorate?
I think it's interesting. I think one part of this is something which is familiar to us today, isn't it? Which is that there can be enormous political machinations, changes, crises going on in Westminster or in Edinburgh or in Dublin or wherever it be, which if you're just the person going on with your life in Lancashire or Lincolnshire, seems very far away. And actually it's not the thing that you're really worrying about, because, you know, you've got to get in your harvest, you've got to marry your daughters, you know, you've got to look after your livestock, whatever it is. So I think one thing is that as historians, we write about and think about the stuff that's happening at the sort of political centre, if you like. And there are lots of documents about that. There are parliamentary sessions and there are acts of the Privy Council. And we, you know, we use all that to tell a story about what's happening, you know, with Charles I and the ship money or, you know, whatever it might be. But actually, one of the things I really wanted to try and do with this book was to consider or try and get a bit closer to how much difference did it actually make to people if you were just out there, you know, you were a tenant farmer or you were an innkeeper or you did whatever it was you did. You know, did the events of the Westminster bubble encroach upon your life or not? And I suppose, you know, it's a thought that's been knocking around. It's been in discussion in the papers over the last decade about Brexit and about other things that have been going on. So it was, you know, it was in my head. And I think in trying to explore that in the book, a couple of things, you know, came out for me. One was, as you say, it's always important to remember that most people didn't take either side in the Civil War. Most people kept their heads down because, you know, they've got kind of more important things to think about. They weren't necessarily that bothered about whether or not, you know, Charles I was taxing counties that he didn't use to tax for stuff. You were sort of used to the fact that there was sort of thing, forces beyond your control. And that continued. Therefore, the number of people who were, you know, heartbroken about political change and determined to commit their lives to doing something about it was probably less than they claimed was the case at the Restoration. But also thinking about, well, what are the things that actually change in your environment in this period? I mean, yes, there's a council of state rather than a king. You know, that might make a difference insofar as, you know, proclamations that are made in somebody else's name. The reality is that actually the things that probably mostly affected you was what it did to your church, which was your, you know, immediate environment, which in some people was much better, some people thought it was much worse. Other people thought, well, as long as it's the same guy, you know, reading from the book at the front, and, you know, they weren't getting too caught up in it. So I so one of the things that's interesting is, although there are big headline changes, quite a lot of those, I think, when you look at what it meant very locally, were less dramatic than you might imagine. And actually the things that bound people together within a locality, intermarriage, you know, attending the same fairs, you know, being part of the same regional calendar of, you know, the seasons and so on, those things were much stronger than the question of whether or not, you know, this constitutional settlement or that, given that you might well not have had enough money to be able to vote anyways, sort of... You know, it's kind of a bit distant. So, I mean, I didn't want to play it down because I think that it did have an effect on people's lives in lots of ways, but I just think it was different to what you might imagine. And I think the kind of particularly for a country after a decade of, or nearly a decade of war, the sort of desire just to get on with things, to have a bit of peace, to not have, you know, warships off the coast, which meant you couldn't get your, you know, consignment of wool over to the Low Countries to sell it, or whatever it was that was part of your day-to-day business. That stuff was more important than, you know, whether it was Oliver Cromwell or Charles I.
Yeah. And I think that continuity that's there, it was often said, and the claim was often made, particularly during the 1930s, I remember, when, again, we always draw parallels, don't we? We're talking about Brexit, we're talking about COVID now, and we always see the past through our own prism. But during the 1930s, it was often claimed that Cromwell was a dictator of some kind, on drawing parallels with Hitler, with Mussolini in particular. I remember even C.B. Wedgwood, who's a great historian of that period, drew those parallels, which she later recanted during the 1950s and 60s. But what strikes me is that, again, when you say ordinary life goes on, because it does, but there's not even the infrastructure there to really impose anything like the kind of military dictatorship we have, or that we've become used to in the modern period, particularly during the 20th century. So, for example, the rule of the major generals was never likely to succeed. I mean, what's your opinion on this? Because of the kind of power of local gentries, because of claims that certain families had over certain territories and certain regions. And many of the people who became major generals or deputy major generals, this was, of course, when the country was divided up into cantons, into regions that were run by militias, whether that could really work given the infrastructure that was available during the mid-17th century.
Yes, I mean, it's really interesting, isn't it? Because, as you say, I think lots of previous interpretations of this period, the sort of Cromwellian period, sometimes called, have been seen very much through the lens of things that happen much later, whether it's later revolutions like the Russian Revolution, the French Revolution, or later sort of military rulers, as you mentioned. But I think that you're so right, which is that you have to sort of put those to one side because they are imposing ideas, experiences of a much later age on a period where central government as a thing was really so different to anything we would recognise now, or that even that existed in those other revolutions. Because essentially, the government of all the parts of the British Isles, but thinking particularly about England, was overwhelmingly a local affair. I mean, central government was tiny proportionately in terms of how the resources it had to marshal. You know, there wasn't a system of income tax that was kind of in any way comparable with anything that we know now. There wasn't a standing army. There was a quite small navy historically. And there was no healthcare or service or anything like that. Churches were financed differently. So actually, if you're living in a place, Norfolk or Cornwall or wherever it is, your day-to-day life, whether it's about, you know, somebody stealing your chickens or what someone's going to do about the poor of your parish, whatever, is all dealt with locally. It's all dealt with by the commissions of the peace, which are local groups of local kind of bigwigs of one sort or another, whose job it is to kind of figure those things out. So I think the thing is that the sort of control that anybody in Westminster could exert over the day-to-day lives of people in England in the 1650s, which was of a completely different order to anything that happened much later. And this thing called the rule of the major generals, which, as you say, was instituted in the mid-1650s as an attempt to kind of try and get the sort of reform and sort of security services of the regime sort of more in control of England, it only lasted 2 years because there really was no hope in a society which was so intensely organised around local government, that anyone, whatever political stripe they were, that was being sent from London to tell you what to do was going to get anywhere. It didn't matter whether you were a devoted Puritan or a royalist. The point is, you're not from around here, you don't know how we do things. And although the makeup of the people who were on the commissions of the peace had changed because of the revolution, but they were still local folk. Whereas somebody turning up who's an ambitious young man in the Cromwellian army arriving from London, I mean, forget it. No one wants to have anything to do with them. So, I mean, added to which, there was quite a lot of kind of working people up in the middle of the night and sort of rummaging through their belongings to look for evidence of treason and so on, which didn't go down very well. So, as you say, the kind of idea that, of the military dictatorship and what does that look like, I think is kind of almost impossible to apply, because the levers and the kind of mechanisms for controlling people's lives really weren't there. And when there was an attempt to do it, it crashed and burned.
It failed miserably.
Yeah.
And you make this very, very convincing case that there's this great middle ground after the war. Even during the war, to a certain extent, it was rather the middle ground. But nevertheless, you do paint these very vivid portraits of people who were at the extremes, what you might call radicals and counter-revolutionaries. And one of those, we might call the radical, is Gerard Winstanley, of course, with the Diggers. And the other one, which is one of the most colourful portraits that you offer us, is that of what we call a counter-revolutionary, a reactionary, which is Charlotte, Countess of Derby, which is a really, really great story. I love that line you have when you talk about her as a woman of tremendous lineage. But quite a formidable character.
Yes. So one of the things that I really wanted to do in the book is to understand what it was like for people on different sides, if you like, different positions in this whole great political maelstrom. Because, it's not a book about who was right and who was wrong. It's a book about what were the different, why did people feel as they did and what drove them on. And actually there are a series of rather extraordinary female, kind of quite military leaders, but women who take very significant roles in military engagements during the Civil War and into the 50s. And one who I was really struck by, as you say, is Charlotte, Countess of Derby, who was actually a French woman. She was born in France. Her father was a French duke. And she, as I say, she had... I like the thought of describing her as having a tremendous lineage, because I think that's how she felt about it. She felt, as did her husband, that there was no bluer blood than that coursing in her veins. But she wasn't... She was a Protestant, came from a Protestant family in France, and her grandfather had been the leader of the Dutch, what's called the Dutch Revolt, the Dutch Protestant movement for independence, which had given birth to the United Provinces of the Dutch Republic in the late 16th century. So she was fueled with a sense of, wonderful kind of heroic, born in the blood of battle sort of, leadership of Protestantism and of, kind of independence. And so, she and her husband, the Earl of Derby, held what was pretty much the last bit of royalist soil in the British Isles, which was the Isle of Man, which held out for Charles II, as it came after the execution of Charles I, right into the early years of the 1650s into 1651. And she's an amazing figure because she was... Although she was no big friend of Charles I, she and her husband were moved away from court. They thought the court was a kind of fickle place for people who let you down.
And not keen on Henrietta Maria.
Because she was not keen on Catholics. It's a kind of reminder that these things don't just fall down, the obvious division lines of class or religion. And she and her husband kept the Isle of Man, which was part of his territories of Derby, as a sort of royalist enclave. A perfect spot for a reinvasion, of course, because it's right in the middle of all the home countries. And her husband went off to join Charles II when he tried to retake the kingdom, leading to the famous defeat at the Battle of Worcester and his hiding in the Boscobel Wood. And she, meanwhile, was on the Isle of Man with... lots of royalists and others who were kind of waiting for the call to go in and join this great counter-revolutionary enterprise. a call which, of course, never came because they were, the Royalists were defeated at the Battle of Worcester. Her husband was executed. But her absolute determination not to give in was extraordinary. And she essentially managed to hold the Isle of Man until finally a massive, thousand-strong army is sent to, actually to Ireland, but stops off to kind of grab the Isle of Man on the way. And she's betrayed by one of the Manxmen who works for the Derby family, who quite reasonably felt that the game was up and that, you know, standing by the Countess of Derby and Charles II wasn't really a route to success. But her the story of her sort of determined resistance, and of how lots of people who were very committed, really committed to the idea of monarchy, felt, I thought was a really interesting one, partly because, you know, the sheer determination to fight back is very vividly demonstrated in her actions and of those around her. Partly because I think it's very interesting about the role of women during this whole period for lots of reasons. I mean, war often is a time where you see the role of women really change. We were suffragettes in First World War famously, but at other occasions. But also because actually there's an amazing kind of codicil to that story, because when she has to finally give up the Isle of Man, which she does, because basically it's swarmed over by thousands of soldiers, the territory is taken away and given to Thomas Fairfax, who's the recently retired head of the army, and he arranges for all the income to be paid to her. And to me, that's just so interesting, because again, you can't just assume that there's, you know, these guys, one lot here and they're on one side, and this lot over here are on the other side, and they're utterly ideologically divided and they hate each other, because that's not how it was. And, you know, there you have the leader of the new model army arranging for the rents from this island to go to this woman who'd been the great leader of the Royalist resistance there. You know, which tells us lots of other things about, you know, the ambiguities, how complicated it was in the case of Fairfax, how much he really regretted how radical a resolution had come of the war, which wasn't what he was aiming for. He would much prefer to see the monarchy stay. So, you know, it's all very human, and I think that's endlessly interesting about the past.
No, that's very interesting, because writing on this period, as we've both done, one of the things that really strikes me about it when I speak to people who are not historians of this period is the way it still continues to divide people on very rigid lines.
Mm.
I'm astonished at the loyalty particularly shown to Charles the First, as you know, we know about the kind of martyr saint, but then you also have the alternative there, which is trial of the man of blood. I got the sense that you were quite sniffy about Charles, that you were not hugely sympathetic to him. And I think that's the kind of opinion I've grown to have looking at it. But Charles is a really relatively simple character, I find, compared to the person at the centre of all this, which is Oliver Cromwell, of course. And I just wondered how, if you changed your mind on him or what you'd thought about him and the kind of engagement with him and indeed other people around him, whether your opinions had changed during the writing of the book.
Yes, that's a really interesting question. I think on Charles I, I think, you know, if I was to sum it up, I'd say he was in many ways quite a good man, but he was a very bad king. And, you know, I think it's perfectly possible to be both those things simultaneously. But on Cromwell, yes, I mean, I felt like I didn't really have a very strong view about him before I started work on this. I suppose I, like lots of people, you know, found what I knew quite unattractive. The brutality of the Irish campaign is pretty hard to get past. You know, the sort of images that we're used to of him, you know, he looks quite sort of tough and, you know, doesn't look like that great company. You can imagine that, you know, in the game of who would you like to sit next to at dinner, he's never going to be, would never have been at the top of my list. So those are my kind of preconceptions, if you like. And I suppose it's sort of, it's the way I write history and research history, is that I just like to try my kind of technique is to put everything over there, all the books, and I like to try to gather all the contemporary material I can, so that I'm just not looking at what other people have said. I'm just taking what is it that we have that relates to this person that's firsthand or and contemporary. And obviously with Oliver Cromwell, we've got, well, not obviously, but it is the case that the material that survives about him is very unbalanced, because you've got a lot of his speeches which were captured and written down because of the infrastructure for doing that in Parliament and so on. There are a number of letters, and then there are various other sort of survivals of in relation to him as a human being. And I found when I gathered it all together that the way I felt about him definitely did change. I came, when you read somebody's correspondence, you read the letters they write to their children, you read how they respond to inconsequential situations, you do, I think, get quite a sense of what a person is like. And it was a surprise to me that he wasn't a fire and brimstone, Puritan father, in the way that there were clearly were lots of people like that, endlessly putting, literally the fear of God into their people and their environments and so on. He was obviously very emotional about God. He'd had this great conversion experience. He was seized with the sense that he was doing God's will. But it didn't, in the expression of that, in his relationships and the people around him, I was really struck by how that was manifested with kind of kindness and humour and generosity in a way that I didn't expect. And I was also really struck by the extent to which he's so little interested in self-aggrandisement. And I think that's pretty rare in people in positions of rulership. If I think about other people that I've worked on in terms of British history, it doesn't come along that often that you get somebody who is so, and then you start thinking about those portraits and how there he is with all his wispy hair and his armour on and everything, and the famous, probably, apocryphal quote about him saying, asking the artist to paint him warts and all. But then you realise that there's a real truth to that, which is a tremendous lack of personal vanity and a lack of desire to feather his own nest. I mean, I suppose one could say, well, his interest in feathering his own nest was in thinking about the nest that was to come, in heaven. Mm. But it certainly wasn't about material acquisitiveness. He wasn't busy acquiring huge fortunes and lands and spending lavishly on things. He was very modest in his aspirations there. And he also, attested, he was open to religious diversity to an extent that was very new. I mean, it was only a bit of diversity. He wasn't interested in traditional Anglicans being allowed to do their thing, which was most people, or Catholics. But the idea that not everybody had to see God in the same way or worship him in the same way was pretty novel. And there is a kind of a sort of small T toleration in that, which I admire. So I came away feeling that he was a more interesting, kinder person of more integrity than I had expected. Mm. I don't believe in sort of goodies and baddies historically. I think it's absurdity. That's not how people are. But I felt like I came to understand a lot more of the things about him that you could feel admiration or sympathy with than I thought I would.
I don't think anyone who reads the book would think that you put people into black and white boxes as goodies and baddies. I mean, it's quite interesting that two more sort of biographies that you set out there is that of Martin Mountnett,
yes,
who is an extraordinary shapeshifter. He's tell us a little bit about him, but he's a person who constantly changes sides. I mean, he's open to any opinion that's going and will feather his nest in that way. But he's also a man of some genius and influence, I would say, on British history.
Yeah, so he's one of these figures, isn't he, that, you and I both write about this century, so he's a familiar name to us, but most people have never heard of him. Marchmont, sometimes Needham, sometimes Needham. And he was a newspaperman. He was the first sort of kind of recognisable figure, really, as a newspaper editor. And of course, this is a period where that in itself is a new thing. Newspapers as a phenomenon have really only been invented barely a generation before, and obviously the great winds of the Civil War whipped it up into a blaze of production of and purchasing and reading of newspapers. And yes, and Marchmont Needham was really the most successful newspaper proprietor of his day, editor. He wasn't somebody who came to this saying, well, I'm seized by the need to have radical reform and I'm going to use newspapers to achieve it. You know, it's the other way around. He was somebody who came from a middling background. His family had an inn in Burford, but who saw the opportunity that newspaper production presented for somebody who was quick-witted and was a master of language and ideas and communication to be able to make it big. And so he switches about four times between being the editor of either a royalist newspaper or a parliamentarian stroke republican newspaper. And one of the things that I love about him is that he was kind of wonderfully irreverent. It wasn't about political allegiances or anything. It was about ducking and diving and finding out how to turn a trick in this set of circumstances, which to me felt like we haven't heard enough about those people, because you know, life would suggest that accounts for quite a lot of humankind. And secondly, the fact that he's really funny. And reading 17th century material, whether it's literature or political tracts or whatever, can be pretty heavy weather. And you read Marchmont Needham's, particularly Mercurius Politicus, which is the newspaper he's principally famous for. And, you know, you could essentially be reading a bit of the, you know, Daily Mirror in slightly different language. But I mean, it's lively and it's snappy and it's got pen portraits of people and utterly irreverent slanders against people. And you could see how somebody who knew how to write like that, knew how to make people laugh, how to paint a devastating pen portrait of Oliver Cromwell, you know, licking his lips at taking control of Parliament or whatever it was, how powerful that could be and how much you could engage people in politics and how much you could guide them, which, of course, you know, came with the territory. But also he's a brilliant figure because he was a real maverick. He obviously was, I tried to find a painting or portrait or print of him, and I never could. I don't know whether you ever found one.
We had this discussion yesterday.
Oh, did you?
Someone claimed it was, but it wasn't.
No.
No, I think I was speaking to Blair Worden about this.
Yes.
Even he doesn't know, so chance have we got?
Anyway, but the descriptions of him make it clear that he obviously was a wonderful, cut a wonderful figure. Even in his 30s, his hair was all gone bald, with kind of funny, kind of tufty hair. And so he was one of the early adopters of the new fashion for wigs, which, this was a new craze of the 1650s, which we often think of as being a time when people sort of dressed very dourly and soberly, but actually it was quite different, really. One of the many novelties of that decade was men wearing wigs. So he wore wigs of different colours. So he had a red wig that he wore sometimes, which he said made it look like he'd been at the gallows, as if his blood had sort of absorbed into it. And he wore earrings, and he was a massive boozer. And his correspondence is full of references to, do you remember that great night we had at the, you know, Rose and Crown? So as a kind of ebullient figure, the sort of progenitor of the newspaper men to come, I thought he was a brilliant character of this age. And he became great friends with two of the most unlikely people. One is John Bradshaw, who'd led the trial of Charles I, and who, when Needham was in his royalist reporting stage, he'd endlessly described John Bradshaw as being, you know, a dog and a coward and a monster and everything. But they became great friends. And the other person he became great friends with was John Milton. You wouldn't have thought, you know, a more unlikely pair would be imaginable. But it just goes to show these were all human beings. And just like we've all got slightly unacceptable friends, or we may be unacceptable friends to our friends, you know, people get along, they make each other laugh, they develop relationships in spite of the sort of political allegiances or, you know, differences of profession or whatever it might be. And I felt he was a great window on some of that and the richness of this age.
No, and that comes through very well. through the book, I mean, brilliantly. But to a certain extent, that colour that you've just given us there, particularly with Marchmont, we always think of the Restoration as this great break, that there ends this dour, this drab period in British history, and suddenly the Restoration's there, and it's all the Merry Monarch, and it's lots and lots of colour, and lasciviousness and everything else. But your book argues, not explicitly, but implicitly, that there's a continuity there.
Mm.
That in fact, Charles has to react in some way to that and has to continue many of the threads of that, the protectorate period, the interregnum, because he can't really react too heavily. He has to walk a tightrope in many ways. And I think George Monk, who is another shapeshifter, another person who changes sides periodically, who is very much the military agent of the Restoration of Charles, understands that too, that they have to bring on, they have to bring into the fold former opponents. They have to tell people who have been, or argue with people who've been strong supporters, you know, to temper themselves. There's more of a continuity between the interregnum and the Restoration than perhaps might be obvious.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I think the intention was for there to be more of a continuity even than, you know, actually came to pass. But it's very clear that when the restoration of the monarchy wasn't really the product of, you know, the great outpouring of desire for Charles II to, or Stuarts, to return from the populace of the nation. I mean, in a sense, if you'd had a sort of referendum on it at any point, I'm sure we would have voted for the return of the monarchy, because that's kind of what people knew. And because there was enough that was unsatisfactory about the Republic through those years. But nonetheless, that wasn't the basis on which political decisions were made at this point. So that's sort of immaterial. The point is that the Republic had become so destabilised by the death of Cromwell, and then the inability of those that were left to find a kind of a constitutional setup that was going to hold. And as a consequence, the essentially sort of military takeover that happens in a very complicated couple of years right at the end of the 1650s got to the point where even somebody who's a general in the Republican army thinks this has to stop, which is when George Monk begins the process of coming to London, taking control, enabling Parliament to meet fully, and then that in turn leads to the return of the monarchy. But it wasn't, you know, it was the failure of every other alternative that really led to that. And one of the things that's very interesting is that Charles II, very different man to his father, different as day and night, really, who's still only in his 20s, was really unvindictive, fundamentally, about what had gone before. He was not the sort of person who was determined to wreak revenge on everybody who had been part of this. He took the view that we should be about looking ahead, not looking back. You know, I don't want to have too many sort of hangings and burnings of people. You know, what's past is past. This is, you know, the restoration should be about a plan for the future that's going to be happy and harmonious. And actually the deal that was done between essentially George Monk and the agents of Charles II and Charles II himself in the early months of 1660, which were the bones of what the restoration was, envisaged a much more kind of moderate course than actually in the end happened. Partly because that deal was all about trying to find a bit of a compromise. Well, yes, the monarchy was coming back, but the Church of England wouldn't have to go back to how it was exactly before the Civil War. It could be broader. Some of these, you know, nonconformists, as we would now call them, could, you know, would be able to be encompassed within the church. It didn't have to be too prescriptive. And, you know, the various people who'd been prime movers in the protectorate, you know, wouldn't all have to be executed. They could just sort of quietly bow out and it would be fine. In the event, what happened was that sort of appetite for moderation was overwhelmed by the sort of furious royalists who were not happy at all with the thought, hang on a second, we've been in exile, we had all our land seized, you know, we fought for the king, and now we're seeing all these people being let off, you know, where is the, you know, justice that they deserve? And what about the church that, you know, Charles I died for? We want that back. We don't want this new, more moderate settlement. And when the elections, which took place in 1661, which created what's commonly called the Cavalier Parliament, it's called the Cavalier Parliament for good reason, which it was overwhelmingly full of people who kind of identified as Cavaliers before the war or during the war, and they essentially undid quite a lot of this rather clever compromise arrangement that had been devised between Monk and Charles II in 1660. So the restoration of the monarchy became a more hardline reinstatement of what had been before the Civil War than actually had been intended, because, you know, essentially the royalists couldn't really let it go, even though Charles II was open to that.
The reaction set in. And yeah. I suppose there we have that kind of ambiguity in the word revolution there. You know, is it a rupture, or is it in the modern sense, or is it a turning of the wheel, a return yes. of the past? Which I think is a metaphor as to what we've used, I think.
Yes, anyway, right. Yeah.
Anna, you've received glowing reviews for Restless Republic, rightly so, I think. And I'm hoping that it's just further evidence of growing public interest in this period. I think I've said before that it's the single most fascinating decade in British history, I'd argue. Well, British and Irish history, I should add there. But it's certainly rich, and I think it's all the richer now, thanks to your book. So thank you, Anna.
Well, thank you very much. And it was a real pleasure to talk about it with someone who's themselves a great expert in this era.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.